If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. What did the Tudors eat for breakfast? What's the oldest recipe book? And how long have people been vegetarians? Well, in our latest Everything You Wanted to Know episode, we're tackling your questions on the history of food with the culinary historian, Annie Gray. Thank you very much for joining me, Annie, to talk about the history of food. So we've had loads of listener questions in on, I think it's fair to say, quite a varied range of topics. So we're going to work our way through those. And I should say before we start that, as with a lot of these Everything You Wanted to Know podcasts, it's probably not going to be everything that you want to know about the history of food, but hopefully it should whet the listeners' appetites, sorry for the terrible pun, and give them ideas of some more avenues to investigate. So I'm going to start us off with a question from Nathan Bayliss, who got in touch on Facebook. Are there any foods from the past that we don't have today that you wish you could try? And I'm just going to add on my own bit there, which is, and are there any that you definitely would not want to try?
I'm going to answer the second bit first by saying, no, there's nothing that I wouldn't try. Although in some cases, I think I'd only want to try a small bit, but I do think it's important to be adventurous. And also, I suppose I'd have a stipulation, which is that, and it has to have been prepared by someone who knows what they're doing. So if I'm going to try something like cow's udder, which I would imagine to be relatively bouncy, I'd like it to be prepared by someone who's really good at cooking cow's udder. Because let's face it, you can have things today where you eat it and think, this is the best thing I've ever eaten. And then it's cooked by someone else and you think, oh my God, I'm never going there again. So that's the second part. The first part, I'd quite like to try swan. Mm-hmm. Obviously, kind of illegal today, and also quite particular in the past. You had to get cygnets from that year's brood that were fattened up, and then you ate them before they reached the end of their first year. Otherwise, apparently, from somebody who has eaten swan, they're quite nasty, tough and oily. So I'd like to try cygnets because it was such a big feast food in the past. there's various things sort of like fruit and vegetables grown in the past where the modern varieties, I suspect, are slightly different. So it would be interesting to try those. So a lot of the things I'd like to try, it's more about farming techniques and differences than it is necessarily about the foods themselves, because we can usually find the food itself or a modern version thereof. But I don't know whether, for example, a medieval chicken was very, very different to a modern chicken, as long as the modern chicken is fully free range and has been dry hung and has, you know, those kind of things. So I'd quite like to try things that have been grown or produced in the way they were in the past.
That's a really, really interesting question, isn't it? About the difficulties of recreating the tastes of the past. It's not as simple as buying a chicken from Asda or Tesco and cooking it in a medieval way, is it?
No, it isn't. And it's one of those things where, can you ever really reach the past? And I suppose with food, you can certainly get halfway there using modern ingredients. But of course, even our mindsets are different. So if I eat an apple, I eat it with my modern mindset. I don't eat it with the mindset of somebody in, say, I don't know, the early medieval period where you've got your apple from a monastery. But I think it is quite interesting when you really take it back to basics. I've got colleagues who work at the historic royal palaces, so mainly at Hampton Court, where you can go and see teams of cooks cooking food in the Tudor era. And one of the chaps there at one point did a huge sort of public experiment to look at how flour was bolted. So something as simple as flour, you think, right, I'm going to the supermarket, I'm going to get flour and recreate this bread. But if you go back just a couple of hundred years, flour was bolted. And that meant that you passed it through different sieves. So you had six grades of flour, ranging from pretty much bran all the way up to what was known as firsts. And that was the stuff you used to make Mauchnet loaf, or the very, very posh stuff that was very, very white. And white bread at that point was regarded as what you ate if you were genteel, if you were upmarket. It suited your, you know, genteel digestion, which couldn't cope with coarse bran, and you didn't want to fart, basically. So you had white bread. But when you sort of sit and you actually bolt these things through different types of sieves, you realise the work involved. So first of all, you realise how expensive white bread must have been and why, but also how many grades of flour we've lost. So when you make bread from the past, and you say you're making bread for a middle-class context and you're trying to recreate that, what type of flour do you use? And then you add in the fact that actually now our flour is made from wheat, where effectively every head of wheat is a clone. So our wheat is very, very consistent. We know what's in it. But if you go back to, say, 1820 and before, you have things called land races, which is where you sow your field with as many varieties of corn as you can do, loads and loads of different grains, einkorn, spelt, wheat, da, 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 da. And whatever suits that field grows the best. So year after year, your field gets more refined and gets a different variety of grains in. So every field is subtly different. So every bag of flour is subtly different. And then when you sieve them on top, you have six different grades of flour. It's a lot like kind of terroir today, as the French talk about it in terms of wine and that kind of thing. But it does mean that in terms of just something as simple as bread, arguably we can never recreate it. That doesn't mean it's not worth trying, and it certainly doesn't mean it's not worth trying in a sort of public history context. But these are questions that are quite interesting. So if I could try foods from the past, it would be to see how big that difference is, so that I know when I'm reconstructing things where the differences lie.
Fantastic. So to take us right back to basics, we've got a question from Jack Howland 123, who asks, when did humans start cooking with fire? I don't know whether that's more of a prehistory archaeologist's question, really, than a food
historian.
Well,
it is. It's also a really debatable question, weirdly. You kind of think the answer must be quite obvious, because we've dug, archaeological wise, at so many different sites. But there's loads of arguments over it. I mean, it is pretty certain that Homo sapiens always cooked with fire. So right from the beginning of our particular species. But there are arguments about how much earlier than that it happened, because you get sites where you've got, for example, shells that have clearly got burn marks on. Well, brilliant. Okay, clearly cooking with fire, except maybe not. Maybe it was a lightning strike where people then came out afterwards and scavenged. So the evidence is really, really hard archaeologically. And there's varying schools of thoughts as to whether we started controlling fire and cooking with it 40,000 years ago or 250,000 years ago. Or, I mean, you can kind of pluck a figure, really. There's a really good book, though, by Richard Wrangham called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. And his argument actually looks at it from a sort of evolutionary anthropological point of view. So his argument is actually the crux point came about 1.9 million years ago when Homo erectus first appeared, and that the point where Homo erectus first appeared, where we started to walk upright, was driven by our control of fire. So there were two stages in the evolution of modern mankind, and one is eating meat, which enabled us to come down from trees and start to evolve, because meat has got so many more nutrients and proteins in it and stuff, and it allowed us to get bigger and get stronger. And then this other point where we started cooking, and that's the real point where you start to see really kind of sort of speeded up evolution. And it makes a lot of sense as a thesis, because we know, even from studying modern people, that raw food, we will not get the nutrients from it. Those people that live on raw food diets are not getting the nutrition they need from their food. And a raw food diet will get you really thin, but you might also die of malnutrition. So cooking enables us to get much, much more from our food. And that really is the secret to humanity's success.
Okay, so we're going to jump forward just a couple of millennium now. to another first in the history of food, which King Louis on Instagram asked, what's the oldest cookbook that's ever been found? And are they recipes that we would recognise? I'm sure there's debate about this as well.
Well, there isn't actually. There are cookery books as in recipes or sort of lists of things. And then there's printed cookery books that we would recognise. So the oldest kind of recipes are Mesopotamian tablets. There are three clay tablets, and translated, there are recipes in heavily inverted commas for stews in these that you could follow if you knew what to do, because it's literally just a list of ingredients, but it's clear that they are recipes. And really up until the sort of medieval era, you find occasional books such as that, not published books. One of the most famous, which I suspect that most people will have heard of, is Apicius, which is kind of, it's been termed the first cookbook or the first Roman cookbook. There's lots of dates attached to it because it seems to have been the product of many, many people. But the normal date given to it is about 10 AD. So, okay, fine, you've got this cookery book, but it's not a published cookery book. And yes, you can cook from it. And there are some really, really good modern versions of Apicius. So if anybody does want to cook Roman food, I would say look for translations by Sally Granger. And the recipes are really nice. They're absolutely brilliant. But is that a cookery book, or is that an aide memoir written down and circulated? It's the same with some of the early manuscripts. So there's another one by a man called Taillevant. There's various medieval manuscripts. And as you move into sort of 12th, 13th, 14th century, you get more and more of these manuscript books. So the first one in Britain is a thing called The Form of Curry. The first one, I should point out, that we have surviving. And there's copies of that, several copies. So it's not that there's one. It was written down and circulated. And The Form of Curry was written for the royal kitchens in about 1390. And again, if you know what you're doing, you can follow the recipes. And although they are written in Middle English, they are translatable. You can cook them. You have to interpret them. Mostly, there are no methods. Obviously, there are no timings. There are no temperatures. There's nothing like that. It's literally just a sort of, you know, take this, do this, smite this, seethe this. So you can follow it. And again, you can get modern translations of it and modern interpretations of it, I should say, and you can cook those recipes. And that's all great. And there are lots and lots of books you can buy again today on medieval manuscripts and cooking. So we've got quite a lot of information, but they're not cookery books per se. For that, you have to wait really until the 15th century, and you start to get printed cookery books pretty much as soon as the Bibles come off the printing press. Then you start to get cookery books in Italy first, and then spreading quite rapidly across the rest of Europe. So once you get to the Tudor period, then you can get quite a lot of printed cookery books that we would recognise. They're still not very easy to follow, but that's still the case in the 18th century. And a lot of them, I mean, you know, these are printed books. They're really expensive. They're aimed at people who know what they're doing and don't need to have methods given to them. So it's a longer answer than perhaps you were expecting, but there's evidence of recipes, there's evidence of recipe writing, then you get printed and it sort of snowballs from there. But literacy rates were relatively low as well in the Tudor period and into the 17th century. And it's not really until the late 17th century, early 18th century, that you get lots of printed cookery books, and they coexist with manuscript books right up to the present day. I mean, I'm sure most people have got, you know, a book they keep scribbles in or cutouts from magazines and things like that. So the two coexist. And it's, I mean, they're a brilliant thing to study and they're a brilliant thing to cook from.
And just a quick question on the form of curry. Obviously, when you say the form of curry, most people's minds will think of curry, the dish that we know today. There's no connection there, is there?
No, none at all. Curry is just mixing, cutting. It's just a culinary term, the form of curry, the form of cooking, if you like. Curry, the word is late 16th century. So curry comes out of the Indian subcontinent. We then bastardize it. I mean, we are cooking curries from the 17th century, but not quite as far back as 1390 in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, on the note of curries, Kath Casper has asked on Instagram, how was flavour added to food before the arrival of spices?
Well, I think at that point, you've got to say, what do you think mustard is? Because mustard's native to Britain. So even in countries that do not have the spices that we consider as quote unquote spices, so I guess things like chilli and cardamom, coriander, those kind of things, even before those started being imported into Western Europe, there were spices. And also there are foods like onions, leeks, garlic, lots and lots of bitter leaves. There's loads of things with flavour. The diet of most people was vegetable based because that's all they could afford. But there's loads of ways. Wild garlic, all the sort of stuff we forage for today in inverted commas would be just stuff you ate in the past. And we get spices very, very early. I mean, the Romans are trading in spices. Pre-Roman people are trading in spices. Spices are something, as soon as you taste them, you're like, brilliant, zing me up. So pepper is a huge spice that's massively imported. A lot of what we would call old world spices are being imported in quite large numbers throughout really recorded history. So things like cinnamon and ginger and cloves, cloves are like gold dust, nutmeg, all these things we have well before the advent of the sort of modern chilies and that kind of thing. Then you've got the new world spices, so that basically means chili, that then get exported from South America, usually by the Portuguese and the Spanish, taken to India, grown there, change the course of Indian cooking as we think of it today, etc., etc. But, you know, there were lots and lots of ways to flavour food before modern spice blends. And a lot of those ways were very subtle. So if you eat medieval cuisine, the flavours are things like rose water, which is very, very popular, lots of pepper, lots of ginger. A gingerbread from the medieval era is incredibly complex because you've got ginger, pepper, cinnamon, cassia bark. You might well have cloves, you might well have cardamom, coriander, all of those in a gingerbread. So in many ways, the food of the past is much more subtle and much more complex than much of the food that we eat today. So I think it is very dangerous to suggest that everything was bland. A lot of it was, don't get me wrong, but a lot of food today is really bland as well.
Yeah. So you mentioned there the arrival of chilies in India. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about that and the transformative effect it had on Indian cuisine, because one of the most popular internet search terms that we've come across is Indian food history. I think people are always intrigued to know about the history of that.
Yeah, and I think as well in the British context, Indian food, you know, today it's virtually a national dish to have generic curry. And one of the questions I'm always getting asked is, when did we have curry? Or people didn't have curry in them days, I get told that. And it's a really fascinating story, the kind of interactions between different cultures and the way in which globalization and colonialism, let's face it, have changed the foodways of different cultures. So you have a thing called the Columbian Exchange, which really gets going once the Spanish in particular start to discover and then colonize South America. And that is the process of bringing across foods from the New World to the Old World. And that's not just chili, although that's probably the one we would think of most, but it's things like tomatoes, avocados, the turkey, pumpkins, things like that, some of which are really important straight away. I mean, a turkey, everyone's like, oh my God, it's a huge bird. It tastes so much nicer than peacock. Bring it on. So certain foods catch on really quickly, both in Western Europe and across the rest of the world. Other foods are somewhat slower to take off. So the tomato, we introduce and grow ornamentally for a long time. And then eventually people start going, do you know what? It's actually quite cool. Let's start having it. I know, let's make a sauce. And that's kind of late 18th century. But what you find is, of course, people are colonizing lots of different areas in the world. Or at that point, actually, they're just trading with different nations. So the Portuguese and the Spanish and the French and the British are all very much involved in what is now India and Pakistan, Bangladesh, the Indian islands as well. So, of course, they're trading with South America, but then they come back to Spain and then they think, I quite like these foods, I'm taking them with me to this other place. And slowly a lot of foods do travel across the world. And where you've got cuisines that have, say, one spice in, which could be pepper or long pepper or cubeb pepper or grains of paradise or any of these other things that we don't eat anymore, but which we use to flavour food at the time, sometimes people go, let's swap that in and see what we think. So chili is a really good example because, of course, it's now such an integral part of Asian cuisine and in many, many forms, fresh, dried, you know, there are so many different varieties. And in Britain, we use cayenne pepper enormously in the 18th and 19th centuries. Independently of the fact that we're cooking curry, cayenne is like this sort of spice du jour. So those go across to India, they get grown, they enter Indian cuisine. We then pick up Indian cuisine and bring it back. There's a constant, if you drew lines across the globe showing where foods go from and where they come to and how they get re-imported and re-exported, and you know, you'd have kind of this scribble. A turkey is a great example because we call it turkey. Why do we call it turkey when it comes from, you know, South America and the bottom of North? What is this? But it's because it got re-imported to Britain via Turkey. So we called it turkey. It's bonkers, but absolutely brilliant when you start to look at these things and how they spread and where they spread. And, you know, chocolate's another one that sort of comes across, spreads up, spreads down, all the rest of it.
Well, Patricia Huskins on Facebook asked, what influence did the food found in the colonies have on the staple diet of Britain? But I think you've done quite a good job there at covering that one off.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is the staple diet is very different to the diet of the rich. So when these things first came in, they would tend to be expensive because they tended to be imports. Turkey's a meat, which means immediately it's not part of a staple diet of anybody because meat was something that was relatively rare. Turkey did become a staple for the rich very quickly because they liked it, tomatoes less so, et cetera, et cetera. So it kind of took about 200 to 300 years from the first discovery of those things for them to enter into what I would call the staple diet, as in something that's being eaten by the majority of people. But certainly they did have a lot of influence. And with something like curry, you see that being talked about in sort of the late 16th century, so 1570s, 1580s. Eaten in the 17th century, 1670s, 1680s, maybe a little bit by a few people coming back from India, becoming popular in the 18th century when you could buy curry powder ready-made and you could go to coffee houses and eat what was by then called curry. And then it booms in the 19th century when it becomes a leftover dish, so far removed from anything anybody would have been eating on the Indian subcontinent that it's unbelievable. You know, it becomes this sort of thing that's yellow. And then, of course, you fast forward to the 1960s and people are eating Vesta curries and it's travesty. But on the other hand, those Anglo-Indian curries are very interesting, even if they're a bit weird. And then you kind of come full circle now where we're rediscovering the food of India and indeed the other parts of that continent and going, actually, this stuff is amazing. It's nothing like what I grew up with, but it's amazing. And so we've kind of, it's taken us about 300 or 400 years to discover that the food's really nice if you don't, you know, add pineapple to it or something.
Mm. You mentioned that we were a bit slow on the uptake of tomatoes. And Shep Stegall on Instagram did ask what you can tell us about the origin of tomatoes. I just wanted to broaden that out a bit because a lot of people search for the history of Italian food. And of course, tomatoes are fundamental to Italian food. So what can you tell us about that connection?
Well, tomatoes are one of those things that look quite cool. So that's why they were grown ornamentally for a long time. And they're a bit dodgy. You know, you look at them and they're red. That's a colour of danger in nature. And they were thought to be related to the deadly nightshade. And people were, they just thought they're a bit dodgy. For a while, they were called love apples because, again, they were red. They looked a bit like a heart. And gradually, people did start cooking with them, especially in Italy. Italy was really the hub of cuisine in the sort of 17th century and slightly before. So Italians became very well known for being Europe's best cooks. Eventually, that then sort of baton passed to France. But a lot of the innovation in European cuisine was being driven by Italy in the 15th, 16th and early 17th century. And tomatoes were part of that, really. Obviously, the Italian climate as well is very good for growing tomatoes. Whereas if you're experimenting with it in Britain, yeah, good luck to you. Especially in the middle of the little ice age in the sort of early 18th century. It's not great without a greenhouse. And they didn't get invented till the 17th century. So really, you know, you can see why it took a while to catch on. And you start to get recipes for them over here, kind of. There are a few recipes for them in the sort of 17th century, but they take off really in the 18th. You get stuffed tomatoes and then tomato ketchup makes its appearance. But just as a rival to walnut ketchup or mushroom ketchup or any of the other ketchups that are in at the time, which are really just a way of flavouring food. So everything in food is very gradual, really. There's no kind of one moment where suddenly everybody starts eating something. It's always a process of 50 to 100 years.
Mm-hmm. So next we have a really interesting question from Naomi Warwick on Facebook, who has asked, how has food contributed to the development of national identity and nationalism?
Gosh, well, I could probably write a book about that. But the short answer is, massive, massive contribution to absolutely every nation's identity at every point through history. But if I narrow that down and look at Britain, we today think of ourselves as multicultural and eclectic, and we point to the fact that we eat curry and fish and chips and all sorts of other things at the same time as if that's what you want to, that's your version of Britain. The other version of Britain is the fish and chips, roast beef, beer swilling version of Britain. They both coexist. And if you are British, you may pick one or the other, or you may drift between two, or you may not think about it, but they do coexist. And if you are not living in Britain and you think, let's go and have a British, what's it going to be? Is it going to be roast beef and a full kind of roast dinner? Or is it going to be fish and chips? Or is it going to be a full English breakfast, which is the other thing I think that is really a very, very British, stereotypical British food. And those things, we might sort of smile about them today, but they were really, really important in the past. If you look at the 18th century in particular, which is a really formative period for national identity, and anyone who's really interested in the subject, there's a very, very good book by Linda Colley on the sort of way in which the late 18th century contributed to national identity and where all this comes from. But one of the things for the British at that point was this idea of beef and plum pudding. Those were the British foods. So plum pudding's basically Christmas pudding, and you'd eat the two together. It works. It works really well, because it's like chutney. Yeah. Okay. Think of it as chutney.
Okay.
Because you've got all those kind of dark, fruity flavours. So anyway, any municipal feast, so coronation feast, birthday feast, coming of age feast, Christmas, you know, you name it, if it's a shindig, beef and plum pudding and beer. And you have these enormous municipal feasts where thousands of people, there's one in Cambridge where 37,000 people are given beef and plum pudding to celebrate Queen Victoria's coronation. And they all sit on Parker's Peace, sort of laid out in huge tables, but you only get invited if you're deserving. So beef and plum pudding is a huge symbol of Englishness, and it's used quite aggressively and very overtly in things like political cartoons and satires, and both written and visual. So if you think of Gilray or Rowlandson, in fact, if you put into Google or any other search engine, you know, Gilray Rowlandson beef plum pudding, you'll get things like there's a cartoon called the Plum Pudding in Danger, which is all about Napoleon carving up the world, and the world is represented by a plum pudding. There's another one where Napoleon is tied to a stake while John Bull and his wife, the symbol of Englishness, are cutting into an enormous plum pudding and an even bigger sirloin of beef. So this is a really important trope. And the idea is, it goes beyond that. It's the kind of underlying idea is that Britain, or the British person, British man in the street, is represented by a butcher. John Bull's a butcher. He eats meat. Other nations can't afford to eat meat. Therefore, straight away, we're better than anyone else. Also, we eat meat, which means that we are big and strong and tall, and we can fight the French. And the French, as everybody knows, live on soup maigre, which is turnip soup, and frog's legs, because they're all poor and they're all weedy. And every satire you see as a French, because it's mainly anti-French propaganda, has a bandy-legged Frenchman who's sort of pigeon-chested and sort of a bit effete looking, and put against the doughty Englishman who beats them up and then has breakfast. So it's, you know, it's very easy to smile and laugh, but they're really, I mean, they're very dangerous caricatures apart from anything else, because it all feeds into the British sense of superiority, the British sense of isolationism. You know, these things were alive and well in the 18th century, but they still affect our mentality today. And the number of people who say that their favourite meal is a steak, and it may well be, but I also think it's because of this trope that's sitting in the back of our heads about what is British. It's a bloody steak. It's about beef husbandry and about masculinity and about, you know, yeah, it's really unrefined, not like this frou-frou French stuff. I mean, God, who needs sauces anyway? And that is absolutely the attitude of the 18th century. And it's also a lie, because the aristocracy were all eating frou-frou French sauces anyway, because, you know, why wouldn't they? But then they'd claim they're a British and they'd put some beef on the sideboard anyway.
While we're talking about British national dishes, James Isherwood did ask about fish and chips. And he did ask, when did fish and chips become seen as a British national dish?
Fish and chips makes their appearance as a thing together, really, in about the 1860s. So the lovely thing about fish and chips is that fried fish were essentially came out of Jewish culture in the East End, because you couldn't cook on the Sabbath, so fried fish would be served. And chips seem to have made their appearance in France in the late 18th century. So the British national dish is a mixture of Jewish emigre food and French food, and Italian food if you have ketchup, or French if you have mayonnaise. And, you know, it's brilliant. So it appeared sort of around the 1860s. Manchester claims to have been the site of the first fish and chip shop. So does London. We'll never know. And it took off really quickly because fried fish and chips was really tasty, really nutritious and really cheap. So it very quickly became a working class food. And I suppose it was really kind of the Edwardian period or around the First World War that it became very much a British national food. And it was very much recognised as such. So to the point that in the Second World War, it wasn't rationed because it was seen as so vital, not just to the health of the nation, but to the morale of the nation.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I mean, the whole coronation of George IV, to be fair, I'd quite like to go to. I'd like to watch his ex-wife banging on the door, screaming at him. I mean, it's so farcical. And then I'd love to go down to Brighton Pavilion with him and see what the kitchens looked like before they ripped all of them down and left only one room of it.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Sweet tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, but we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. A powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
So we've got a few questions now about slightly more healthy diets, but actually just generally to start us off, Susan Barker asked, when did diet culture or dieting become a thing, essentially? Did people always make a connection as well between food and health?
Yes, food and health really so much. Obviously, if you're going to eat food, it's going to affect you. So food has been associated with health as far back as it is possible to say. The prevailing theory for a lot of history was a thing called Galenic theory, which is the theory of the four humours. And the idea was that you were choleric or sanguine, melancholic, or I can't remember the other one, but you were built up of these things and what you ate would directly affect your humour. If you were ill, it was because your humours were imbalanced. So and it's very complicated because all the foods had properties and they could have a temperature property and a moisture property. So things could be cold and moist. It's lettuce. So cold and moist would be a lettuce. But obviously, if you've got a cold, it's because you're cold and moist. So what you need to do is eat a hot, dry food. And it's not always logical. I mean, ginger was hot and dry, but then I think so was white wine. So sugar was kind of neutral because no one really knew. And it was kind of nice. So you don't want to kind of put it too far to one side because then you might not be able to eat it. But the idea was you ate foods to balance your humours and then you would be healthy. Add to this another thing called the doctrine of signatures, which was a way, if you look at foods, it will have in it a way of telling you what it does. This is God's way of telling us what foods do. So if you look at clary sage, the flowers are very blue and spiky, it's going to do something blue and spiky to you. It's the leaves are furry, it'll give you good hairs, or, you know, there are loads of different things. There's cleavers, which are sticky sweetheart to sort of most people, are long and thin. So if you eat those, you're going to lose weight. I mean, you will lose weight because they're horrible and they have no nutritional value whatsoever. But a potato, I mean, potatoes are really debatable. It looks like a leper. It looks like skin that's coming off. This is if you are obviously in the 17th century. So if you eat the potato, will it cure your leprosy or will it cause your leprosy? And this is, you know, these are the stuff that debates are made out of. It's why so many foods are labeled as aphrodisiacs. Because if you're sex obsessed, which most humans are, and you squint, you can kind of make a penis or a vagina out of almost anything. And people aren't stupid. They are aware if you eat too much, then you're going to get fat or it's going to affect you in different ways. Gout, of course, is one of the most obvious things in the 18th century. Gout is rich man's disease, and it normally is men, because they're the only people that can afford to eat an awful lot of seafood, drink red wine, drink port, drink brandy, eat a lot of red meat, you know, all these things that contribute to gout, very much a rich person's disease. But in terms of losing weight through diets, well, people have always gone on diets. If you look at, for example, Princess Victoria, later Queen Victoria, her journals, she started skipping lunch when she was a teenager because she decided she was overweight. So quite clearly, people know exactly what's going on. But the first diets, as we would kind of call them, brand them and sell them, were 19th century. And some of them are extraordinary. There's a thing called Fletcherism, which is about chewing your food a lot, like 40, 50 times. And then in its most extreme form, you then spit out the food and you just swallow the juices, which is kind of interesting, I would have thought, at a dinner party. You can get tools to help you with your Fletcherism. There's a kind of thing that looks like the... It's really scary. It looks like a sort of torture implement, like a sort of comb with knives on, and you run it back and forth over your food and it chops it all up for you into teeny, teeny, teeny pieces. And then you swallow that, or chew it rather, and then you can spit it out. Calorie controlled diets come along in the 1920s. There's a thing called the Hollywood diet, which is basically grapefruit and black coffee and cigarettes. I mean, a lot of them will help you lose weight. They are not healthy dietary changes in most cases, just as most diets aren't. You know, the only way, sadly, to losing weight and keeping it off is to change what you eat and what you, how you think about food. So all of these things are diets in the modern sense, as in you go on them for 6 weeks, you lose loads of weight, you come off it, you put it straight back on again, you go back on the diet, and someone somewhere makes an awful lot of money out of you doing it.
Mm. Something else that we've had a few questions on is vegetarianism and veganism. So both Mezzy Christian and Matthew Smith, they asked, is vegetarianism and veganism, are they modern phenomenons or do they have an older history?
They have a much older history. Early vegetarians were called Pythagoreans because Pythagoras was supposed to be a vegetarian, verging very much on the vegan, actually. For most of their history, certainly vegetarianism, veganism is more modern, and certainly in the way that we see it today. So veganism really is a post-1960s development. Vegetarianism is, in the past, very much tied up with religion and also with protest. So for some people, especially those that were religious, and especially those in monasteries or nunneries, they would give up meat and animal products because it was seen as something that holy people should do. In fact, if you were Catholic, if you are Catholic today, you have meat-free days. So the early church, right across Europe, the early Catholic Church, Wednesdays, Fridays, Sundays, quite a lot of saints' days, about half the year, were meat-free days. So medieval cuisine is a really good place to start if you're vegetarian and looking for a way into history or the history of food. Because in the medieval period, we had what were known as fast days, and they were meat-free. So they were meat-free in a kind of like fairly, there were grey areas. So seals and otters and things like that, and beavers' tails and certain seabirds were not meat because they were in the sea. So that was fine. And you could pay a fine and get out of it. So it was all sort of a little bit kind of fudgy. But in theory, you had meat-free days. So instead of milk, you would consume almond milk. There would be no butter, but you would use vegetable oils, all the things that you would see as tropes today.
Yeah.
You know, almond milk really isn't new. And a lot of those foods are really, really, really good. But you could eat fish. That's the crucial difference. So if you're a vegetarian who eats fish, all those medieval recipes are perfect for you. Porpoise, sturgeon, dolphin. Not all of it's great. And also, you know, things like jellies. You wouldn't set a jelly with gelatin derived from animals. You set it with isinglass, which is the swim bladder of a sturgeon. So there were really good, really very ingenious ways around eating meat. Fast forward to the 17th century, and we have left the church in Rome, and fast days are still kind of being kept by some people, but not very many at all. So at that point, vegetarianism, sort of as a movement, but not called vegetarianism yet, is very much part of society, but it is seen as very cranky. There's a guy called Thomas Tryon who writes a lot of vegetarian books, and he's very much tied up with religion and about protest as well. In the 19th century, vegetarianism becomes associated with working class protest because it is seen that if you give up meat, then you are stepping outside the norms of society, and it's a really good way to do it. By the late 19th century, it's associated with suffrage because if you are a woman and you decide you're not going to eat meat, again, you're stepping outside this kind of bloody, masculine, patriarchal society, and early vegetarian restaurants are very much associated with women. And then that's also when the Vegetarian Society is founded. The modern movement, as in concerned about animal welfare, has its roots in the 19th century. So up to that point, you're doing it because of health or you're doing it because of belief. By the middle of the 19th century, people are saying, look, we don't treat animals well. We cram our chickens. We whip animals to death. We are treating them so badly. A civilized society should not eat meat. And that's where you get the roots of the modern vegetarian movement come from. So it does have a really long history. I think one of the really important things to remember, though, is that the majority of people for the majority of the past were vegetarian because they didn't have a choice. So when it comes to modern vegetarianism, and even more so modern veganism, you cannot have that movement until everybody can afford meat, because there is no point in protesting if no one's going to notice. And that's very much true of veganism. It's very much a movement that can really only exist in a wealthy Western society. Yes, there are exceptions. Of course there are. There are lots of exceptions of, again, it's religious groups mainly who, and I'm thinking obviously of Buddhism and things like that. But in terms of a mainstream movement or anything even approaching the mainstream, you can't do that until you can protest. So when you look at the 19th century, the idea that you would give up meat when most people could only afford a couple of pieces of bacon a week, if that, would be ludicrous.
So to move us on a little bit, Siobhan O'Farrell has a question, which is, what is the oldest genetically modified food?
We have been modifying foods genetically for a very, very long time. You know, we've been selectively breeding crops and cattle since the year dot. It's just that now we modify them in a lab very, very quickly rather than selective breeding and all of the issues that go with that. But I mean, proper genetic modification of crops that can be commercialized, I think it might be 1992 and be a tomato.
Okay. So fairly modern.
It is a tomato, certainly. And it's a States, a USA tomato. And of course, you know, there's also creating the food and then there's allowing it to be marketed as well. And all the safety issues that go with genetic modification and the debates. And, you know, do we want a company to own our food? Should food even be patented? There's all these debates still to come. So the answer is it's very modern. And those things are yet to be debated.
And Laurelise XO asks, when were additives first introduced to food?
I would say define additive at that point. I'm assuming that she means petrochemical additives, in which case we're looking really at the late 19th century. So petrochemical food dyes, massive. I mean, like, you know, God, if you could dye it purple, dye it purple. That late 19th century, this is cool. This is so cool. Get yourself petrochemical food dye, petrochemical food flavouring, add it to your ice cream. Yes, sir. But we've been adding things to our food for a long time. So baking powder is sort of mid-19th century, custard powder around the same time. Food colouring in terms of naturally derived food colourings, well, that goes back to the medieval period, if not before, because all you've got to do is pound some spinach in a pestle and mortar and you've got chlorophyll, you've got green food colouring. But I think in terms of where I suspect the question's coming from, it's late 19th century. And you can see that in the growing debate over food adulteration and what's going into food and how bad it is. And the fact that we start to pass acts out explicitly outlawing those things properly and really enforcing them from the late 19th century.
And what about the emergence of fast food? Where do you see that trend beginning?
At least the Roman period, where you've got people selling lamb chops out of trays to people on the street. If you've got humans and they're going to want to eat fast. So street food, fast food goes back an enormously long way. And modern stuff, the kind of, you know, burgers in baps really is 1920s onwards. But in terms of a fast thing on, I mean, you used to get baked potato man selling baked potato to people in queues for the theatre. And apparently it was a really good, if you were a woman and you were a bit chilly, you could put a baked potato inside your muff and it would keep you really, really warm.
So while we're talking about inventions, genetic modification, additives, all that, let's get on to probably the most important question, I think, of this hour, which is from Rachel O, 2016, which is, who invented the first chocolate bar and when?
Oh, 1847 fries is the short answer. The longer answer is that we discovered chocolate, or rather chocolate was being consumed in South America and Mesoamerica. It came over via the Columbian Exchange and it was drunk at that point. So it was a really beautiful, spiced, often chocolate drink. And that was the way chocolate was consumed for a very long time. 1830s, the Van Huyten process is patented, which is about pressing chocolate to get out the fat. No, if you grind your own beans, the level of fat in a cocoa bean, in pure cocoa liquor, as it's known, is incredibly high. It's very, very difficult to do it in home. And you have to heat the mixture as you grind it, because otherwise you just can't do it. So a process is developed to press out and to separate out the cocoa from the fat. And the fat's brilliant because it's used in the beauty industry a lot and it smells divine. And it's also re-added back into chocolate bars to make them what they are. So 1847 chocolate bar is effectively the cocoa mixed with the right level of fat to make it melt in your mouth, but not be really greasy or gritty or horrible. But it didn't really catch on because it's dark chocolate and people are like, what is this stuff? I mean, honestly, like, I drink my chocolate. Why do I want to eat my chocolate? Like, I'm prepared to put it in ice cream or like in a custard, but not much. And then in the 1870s, you get the development of milk chocolate, which comes out of Switzerland, the Nestle, what will become Nestle, and you know, all that kind of stuff is happening. And from a British point of view, you have a lot of British girls at finishing school in Switzerland who are like, this is amazing. And it spreads really quickly. And so by 1900, there's a huge boom in eating chocolate. So the short answer is 1847. The longer answer in terms of what we would recognise as a chocolate bar and in terms of the growth of chocolate confectionery versus chocolate as a drink is 1870s onwards.
Lovely stuff. So now we're moving into a slightly more random selection of questions. So do forgive me if they jump around somewhat, but we'll see what happens. So Hastagram on Instagram asked, why do you think that Western culture developed knives and forks and Eastern cultures developed chopsticks?
Well, they sort of come from the same root. So if you think of the fork and the chopsticks as the equivalent, then that's it sort of makes more sense. So the earliest cultures, the earliest eating tools that have been found in archaeological sites and so on and so forth have been spoons or proto-spoons, something to convey a sloppy mess from the slop to your mouth. Obviously, you can drink from a bowl, but sometimes you want something else. So spoons are the big one. And knives obviously existed for a long time because how else are you going to butcher your woolly mammoth carcass, whatever it is. So not a woolly mammoth carcass before anybody writes in to go, I don't think you're fine. So you're butchering your proto-deer carcass. But knives, so knives and spoons coexisted for ages in all cultures pretty much. And then you start slowly to get kind of, it branches outwards. So Asian culture develops chopsticks, because they're really useful. And there are two kind of main reasons that seem to be, I'm not an expert on Asian culture, as you point out, and on chopstick use either. But the main reasons that are usually quoted for the development of chopsticks are, first of all, that there was a couple of hundred years where food was very scarce. So cooking techniques changed, especially in China, to be pre-chopped up and pre-proportioned, really. So when you got your dinner, it was lots of little pieces that needed to be conveyed to the mouth. And chopsticks, which were already being used to cook with, were very, very useful for doing that because you could convey small amounts of food to your mouth and sort of elongate the meal. The other thing was that Confucius, who obviously was incredibly important in Chinese culture, said that knives at the table were really not what you should be. It's not a mark of civilization to have a weapon that can kill you at the dining table. So those things sort of both worked together to develop chopsticks. And chopsticks are not pan-Asian. There are lots of Asian cultures that don't use chopsticks. It's very much Chinese. It spreads to Japan as well. But that is in itself a whole essay. In Western Europe, we were using the spoon and the knife. Eating knives were pointy. We know that knives and spoons were being carried by people as well. So you had your own personal cutlery, which you would carry with you. One of the reasons we know it is because virtually every village in Britain claims to be the home of football. And the reason they claim it is because somebody died playing football by falling on their eating knife. Now, loads of villages claim to be the home of football based on this, and it's always the same story. But for me, the main takeout is, why on earth are you carrying your knife with you and then playing a really violent game with it? I mean, surely you'd take it off, right? It just goes to show that, you know, people have been really silly throughout history. So we have knives and spoons for a very long time. And then we start to get the fork. And the fork originates as a thing to eat sticky sweetmeats with at posh tables. So if you've got plums in brandy, they're quite difficult to eat with a spoon. And they're really difficult to eat with a knife because you're going to risk cutting your tongue off. So the fork developed really as a dessert thing just for the dessert table. And then eventually it sort of started to creep into the main course. But it wasn't until the 17th century that we really started to see forks in any quantity in this country. And a little bit later that you started to go to dinner and have cutlery provided for you. And it's one of the reasons that you see a divergence in table manners and eating habits. Because of course it's not very straightforward. We have a tendency in Western Europe to think fork, knife, spoon, that's your cutlery. Anything else is a bit weird. But just look at the way people use it. In Britain, we pick up our fork and we pick up our knife and we use both throughout the meal. But if you look at some parts of America and some cultural norms in America, it's pick up your knife and your fork, chop up all your food, put your knife down, switch your fork to your right hand and use the fork as a scoop. And that's partly because the Americans got the fork slightly later than Britain and at a different point in time. And their version of table manners went in a different direction to the British version of table manners. So it's not that either of them is wrong. It's just that that's a different development. And so chopsticks are just another version. Chopsticks are brilliant as eating tools. And they're really, in a lot of ways, they're a lot more practical than a fork because, you know, you can make them out of virtually anything. And they're a really, really good cooking tool as well. And you see today in a lot of modern kitchens, chefs are starting to use chopsticks to stir and to pick things up and turn things more than tongs because you can get a lot of control with chopsticks. And we used to have pudding sticks and things like that. So there's a lot of similarities. It's just that it's kind of what you see reflected in the culture that you're living in, I suppose.
Mm. So as promised, we're going to jump to a slightly random question now. And Nat on Instagram has asked if you can tell us about Tudor breakfast. Quite specific, but I was intrigued.
Yeah, Tudor breakfast depends on who you are. Again, Tudor dinner is the first thing to point out. Tudor dinner was about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. So you didn't need much. Dinner moves. Tudor dinner is 10 or 11 o'clock. Stuart dinner is kind of 2 o'clock. By the time you get to Jane Austen's time, it's kind of 5, 6 o'clock. If you're wealthy, it gets later and later and later and later till you fetch up with Queen Victoria having a dinner at 8:30 and turning up late every night. So Tudor breakfast, you will have a breakfast pretty much no matter who you are, but you probably won't talk about it. It's not a formal meal because you know you're going to have dinner. So it's probably just beer and bread, maybe some cheese. If you're aristocratic, you might have a bit of pie. You do get the development of sort of formal breakfasts among the very wealthy towards the 1560s, 1570s. And a formal breakfast are where people get invited and they do have a meal together. But that's almost the equivalent in the Tudor period of afternoon tea in the 19th century because of the way in which the meal moves in terms of timings. So the short answer is beer, bread, maybe some cheese. I mean, it's a pretty good breakfast, to be honest.
I mean,
The beer is not strong, I should point out, but it will give you quite a lot of calories, which you need if you're about to go out and do a physical job.
Yeah, it sounds good to me. So here's a quick fire one for you. Dizzy C17 asks, what was pottage?
The staple food of everybody in the medieval period is the short answer. Pottage is just a kind of stew. So everybody ate it. It develops into the word potage, which is the French today for a thick soup. Pottage was, if you're poor, pottage is whatever grain you get, whatever vegetables you can find. If you've got meat, great, but you probably don't have, you stuff it all in together, you eat it. So a classic medieval or Anglo-Saxon pottage would be barley, leeks, bit of mustard seed, some water, stew it all together, eat it. Kind of porridge. And porridge, again, is related to it. If you're wealthy, your pottage might be beef and spices and currants and breadcrumbs, and that develops into plum pottage, which develops into Christmas pudding. So pottage is all things to all people. It can be absolutely minging. It can be absolutely beautiful, but it's essentially stew.
So there you go, Dizzy C. You can go away and make your own pottage because it can be whatever you want.
Yeah, there's even sweet ones. There's strawberry pottage from the Tudor period, which is absolutely lovely. Strawberries and rose water and a few breadcrumbs to thicken it. And it's just divine.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. So this question from Moscow as a dog, first of all, great name. And the question I found entertaining, so I want to put this to you, which is, what made people so picky about offal? But I would broaden that out to say, what are some popular dishes that today some people might be a bit grossed out by?
I find the offal question very interesting. I didn't grow up eating offal. My parents were very much of the, they were born just after the war. And of course, one of the reasons that we don't eat offal much today is because during the war, it was one of the few things you could get off the ration. So it became very popular, but also associated with a time of desperation. So my parents were both brought up not eating offal because their parents had basically just given it up after the war and gone, we're not doing that anymore. So I, when I became a food historian, I had to teach myself to eat offal. And it is a challenge. If you've never eaten it, it is strongly flavoured. And many, many of our foods today are very bland. But I taught myself to eat offal, firstly with kidneys. And the first time I ate a kidney, I had the whole kidney and it's boingy. And it was just, it was a really difficult thing to eat. And I thought, I really don't think I like these. Then I found a 19th century recipe for kidneys where you slice them very, very thinly, flash fry them in butter, add quite a lot of cayenne, salt, and then swill out the pan either with some white wine or with a bit of mushroom ketchup. And you serve them like that. It's sort of quasi-deviled kidneys, I suppose, but not quite. And I thought these are amazing because the textural problem has gone away. And I quite like the uric tang and the way it mixes with the spice. I suddenly realised that offal takes spice. So what I would say is that a lot of people today have not tried offal. And if they have, they've only had it done badly. And I am a firm believer that almost anything is edible as long as you have it done well. There are almost certainly exceptions. So that's the first thing with offal. I think it is associated with poverty today, or has been for a long time, because it used to be very cheap and undervalued. It wasn't associated with poverty in the past, which is one of the reasons it was eaten more widely, because it was meat. And all meat was expensive. So again, it comes down to this idea that most people were vegetarian. So if you take something like humble pie or humble pie, which today people are like, well, it's guts, it must have been disgusting. No way. If you had humble pie, that meant that you had a deer park, and that meant you were very, very rich. So humbles were the innards of specifically of a deer, and they were very highly spiced. You only have to look at the recipes to see that this was food for the rich and very, very pleasurable eating as well. So, you know, a lot of this is about the way in which our culture works, the way in which our values work. I think it's a very silly thing in many ways that people don't eat offal or try to at least find out whether or not they like it today, because we know that there are huge pressures on the environment and that eating less meat and making sure that we really maximise the way in which we use animals is a really key thing going forward. And but there are loads of other things we don't eat today either because we think it's disgusting or just because it's fallen out of fashion or because they're very difficult to produce. There's loads and loads of things like fruit and vegetables in particular that we don't have today. A lot of what we don't sell today or don't eat today is driven by supermarkets. The supermarkets today have a lot of power to dictate what people eat. So if you go to a supermarket, you know, you'll see five varieties of apple, but and people will buy them. But if you go to a market, especially in apple season, you might find 100 varieties. And that's still nothing compared to the 3,000 varieties that you might have found in a Victorian seed catalogue. So we are restricted by the way in which we shop, and we are restricted by our own choices. And it's a very, very complex thing. But I would say, you know, if people think they don't like offal, start kind of at a basic level. Start with maybe some calves liver and bacon. Really good, because bacon obviously will give you the flavours that you recognise. Or do something devil. Don't start with a massive cow's kidney that sits on your plate and really will put you off, because the textures are unrelenting. I really like heart, especially venison heart. But again, I would always slice it very thinly and flash fry it, because otherwise it is boingy.
Next up, we have another entertainingly phrased question from Cloudburst Kingdom, who just simply said, more about people renting pineapples. So that's so intriguing. You have to tell us more. What does Cloudburst Kingdom mean?
They didn't. It's a Victorian myth. The Victorians are really, really fond of making things up about the past. I mean, I suppose this to me is a classic question about food mythology. Food history is one of the most mythologized things. Everything gets mythologized, but food history in particular. So just to take a random selection of things that are always said that are not true. The Duchess of Bedfordshire did not invent afternoon tea. People were not shorter in the past, apart from if they were really poor. There were vegetarians in the past. People did not use spices to disguise tainted meat. What else did they not? People drank a lot of water in the past because it was free and it was cheap. And unless you drank it from a sewer, it was fine. You know, I could go on. There are so many. Simnel cake was not cooked by female servants to take to their mothers on Mothering Sunday, partly because Mothering Sunday had nothing to do with mothers. So obviously I can get quite exercised about many of these things. This pineapple thing is something that does circulate a lot. And I think everyone could be forgiven for thinking it was true because it's written down in the past. It was the Victorians who really do. I kind of blame them for a lot of things, really. But this whole idea that people rented pineapples, ho ho, let's laugh at them, seems to be a Victorian comment on the 18th century. Now, there were foods that people rented. So sugarcraft confectionery, which was very expensive and very time consuming to make. We know people rented that because there are bills. There's one in particular from York that I'm thinking of where you could rent sugarcraft sculpture. And that begs loads of questions. Like, how do you make sure your guests don't eat it so you can return it? How do you clean it in between times? I mean, sugar gets quite dusty. What happens if you drop a bit of wine on it? It's just going to... Anyway, so you could rent certain foods, but not pineapples. Pineapples were first imported into Britain in the late 17th century. There's a very famous picture of probably a gardener at Ham House presenting probably Charles II with a pineapple. And we started to grow them in around 1720. And they were very, very prized. They were seen as symbols of hospitality. They were difficult. They were lovely. They tasted nice. But they were quite popular by the late 18th century. And you could get hold of them if you were middle class or above with relative ease. So people weren't renting pineapples, but they were renting other things. And pineapples did have a massive impact on culture because you could... I mean, you see them a lot of the time in iconography, but also you could get this beautifully designed fruit bowl to display your pineapple that had a kind of like a rondelle on a stick in the middle. So your pineapple would sit on this little perch for a pineapple, and then round it you'd put your other fruit. So because fruit was what you always finished a meal with if you were wealthy, with fruit. So that was your dessert. And you might have ice creams and other things as well, but this huge fruit bowl would be part of it. And they were specially designed ones with pineapples. So pineapples are really cool. And again, there's a very good book on the history of the pineapple. So if anybody really wants to get into it, there is a full book on the pineapple and I will recommend it. It's really interesting reading.
Lovely stuff. And finally, I just wanted to ask you about one of the things that people search most for in food history, which is the best feasts in history. So what were some of the best feasts in history that if you could go back and be a guest at, you would choose?
I do have an answer for this, but it's kind of a fudge in that because I'm a social historian and because I'm very interested in the everyday rather than the great and the good, I would actually want to just go to a normal dinner party. I'd like to go to a couple, really, you know, because I want to kind of look up and down the class system, really. So I would love to go to a royal feast in the Victorian era because I've written about Queen Victoria and I would love to see one actually in action and see how boring it was, to be honest, because she wasn't the greatest conversationalist. So I'd like to see the early stage when it was still à la française, so lots and lots of food on the table at once. That would be cool. So I'd like to go to that and just see how people react and what the food looked like. I'd also like to go to a sort of, I suppose, a middle-class feast in the 18th century and see what that looked like as well. But if I was going to go back in time and attend a feast or a dinner, I'd like to go and see the normal stuff because what I write about, what I research, all of that is trying to bring alive lives that we don't know about. So, you know, I've written a book on Winston Churchill's cook, not Winston Churchill, because there's too much about Winston Churchill. But there are loads of really big, enormous feasts. I mean, you know, George IV's coronation feast would be pretty cool. There was a horse involved. And apparently he only had four of the sort of God knows how many hundred of dishes on offer because he was really nervous. And I mean, the whole coronation of George IV, to be fair, I'd quite like to go to. I'd like to watch his ex-wife banging on the door, screaming at him. I mean, it's so farcical. And then I'd love to go down to Brighton Pavilion with him and see what the kitchens looked like before they ripped all of them down and left only one room of it. But a big feast in history, do you know what? I'm going to leave that to the people that are really into great men striding the world. And I'm going to go downstairs with the cooks and the women that just got on with it, really.
That was Annie Gray. Annie's most recent book is Victory in the Kitchen, The Life of Churchill's Cook. And she joined me to discuss it on the podcast last year. If you'd like to check that out, then just search for Cooking for Churchill on your podcast feed or at historyextra.com. And I'll also be speaking to Annie later this year about her upcoming book, At Christmas We Feast. So check your podcast feeds in December for more on history's greatest festive feasts. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.